I think we'll cover a lot of ground in the hour or so we have available to us. I'm negotiating with Dean Mahoney for you first-year students that if you faithfully stay to the end of this program and really get your hands around it, that will do in lieu of the second semester first-year con law class. Is that a fair deal? I mean, you will know when you leave today all you need to know about the Supreme Court and the Constitution. Now, I will get back to you on whether Dean Mahoney is of the same mind or not. I don't want to predict what he'll say. Our plan this afternoon is, as you know, to look at certain selected cases from the Supreme Court's most recent term. The four panelists will proceed in the order in which they're seated, starting on this end with David Martin, who will look at some of the term's preemption cases, in particular, I think, emphasizing the Arizona immigration case. Leslie Kendrick will then take up First Amendment cases, including, I expect, the violent video case and the funeral protest case. George Rutherglen will then take a look at the class action cases from the term, especially Walmart and AT&T Mobility. And then finally, Tony Heitens. This is an add-on which we've not done before in earlier Supreme Court roundups. He will take a look at four cases in which the law school Supreme Court clinic was involved, and that, I think, will be a special treat. Now, we are being selective. We did consider that maybe the four panelists would take the 80 cases and each one would talk about 20 cases. That idea died pretty quickly, as you can imagine. Now, instead of having a Q&A session this afternoon, what we'll do is when we adjourn, there's a reception. I'm sure the panelists don't mind lingering for a few minutes, so if any of you would like to approach them, questions or thoughts, feel free to do that. Now, let me add a note of historical context to talking about the Roberts Court. As you know, the convention is that one describes the courts in terms of the name of the Chief Justice. Historically, that may or may not be a perfect fit. At any rate, that's what we do. And it struck me in thinking about the Warren Court and courts until the Roberts Court that Earl Warren became Chief Justice in 1953, but the Warren Court, in a very real sense, didn't become a full flower until 1962, the year that Felix Frankfurter left the court and Arthur Goldberg took his place. And it was in that term that the Warren Court really hit stride with a number of important cases, reapportionment, criminal procedure, and so forth. It's interesting that the same pattern seems to have been true of the Rehnquist Court. William Rehnquist became Chief Justice in 1986. But again, it was 9 years later, 1995, that I think you can fairly say that the Rehnquist Court really came of age with cases like United States versus Lopez and some church and state cases and others. Now, that may be a historical accident, but I'm struck by that sort of nine-year period. We are now at the end of the sixth year of the Roberts Court. So I'm bound to wonder, you know, we had a period of, 11 years when there were no vacancies on the court at all until 2005. And then, starting in 2005, in very quick succession, we've had four justices leave the court, Rehnquist, O'Connor, Souter, and Stevens, and then four justices take their place, Roberts, Alito, Sotomayor, and Kagan. So it's really, in many ways, a new cast of characters, and now they're settling in. It's not likely there'll be early vacancies. There might be. But now we can begin to think about, is there something we can describe as being the Roberts Court? Are we two-thirds of the way to another one of those nine-year cycles? So with that in mind, I picked up a copy of the Gazelle Institute of Human Behavior's book on children from age 1 to 6. What are they like, you know, when they're 6 years old? The Gazelle Institute tells us the following. Your six-year-old is a lively creature, dynamic, energetic, and enthusiastic, but one whose life is not without complications. His biggest problem may be his two-way nature. He may be beautiful and bubbly 1 minute, but difficult and quarrelsome the next. Well, is that the Roberts Court at age 6? Yeah, panelists will help us figure this out. Now, let me offer, just setting the stage for the panelists' remarks on the cases, several generalizations about the what strikes me about the Roberts Court at the end of its sixth year. First, no one will mistake the distinctly conservative direction in which the court is moving. Clearly, Alito replacing O'Connor has made a great difference. Indeed, there's one study that says of the 44 justices who've sat on the court since 1937, of the 10 most, of the six most conservative justices during that period, four are on the present court: Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas. So we've got a shift to the right, which I have to say, of course, is episodic. There are exceptions to it. I think, for example, of Kennedy versus Louisiana. Secondly, I think more than in any time in my recollection of the modern court, there's now more of a striking correlation between the politics and expectations of a president who made the appointment and how the justice actually behaves on the court. That used not to be the case. I mean, one was struck by the aberrations, the presidents who were, you know, starkly disappointed in how their appointees would behave. You think of Harry Blackmun, for example, or Stevens, or Souter, the people who moved from where one might have thought they would be. I think that's history. I don't think you're going to see much of that on the present court. I think what we're now seeing on the more conservative side of the court is the fruits of the Reagan administration's agenda back in the 1980s when Roberts and Alito were young lawyers in that particular administration. Thirdly, I think we can talk about judicial activism, aggressiveness, assertiveness. It's traditional to think about the Warren Court as a very activist court. It was. But we now realize that activism is not the prerogative of justices on the left wing of the court, that the right wing of the court can be activist as well. I only have to mention the case term before this of Citizens United, the campaign finance case. Fourthly, that pattern is giving us a more ideologically divided court, maybe in some ways like the divides in the Warren Court. There were 16 opinions this term, that's 20% of the total, that were 5-4, and of those 5-4 decisions, 9 out of 10 were split along straight-out ideological lines. And the conservatives won probably 2/3 of those split opinions. You get very high rates of agreement among, on the right wing of the court, Roberts and Alito, 96% of the time, pretty strikingly high. And on the other wing of the court, Sotomayor and Kagan, 94% of the time. So you can see the rates of agreement there. Fifthly, Justice Kennedy. I mean, it is now perfectly clear that he's in the catbird seat, that he's the one who has the fifth and critical vote in so many important cases. He has replaced O'Connor as the swing vote. He is in the majority in this past term 94% of the time. Roberts was next with 91%. And in 5-4 cases, he was in the majority 88% of the time. So he's pretty much where he comes down tends to be where the court comes down in divided cases. He is, as we know, more conservative than O'Connor. So you get areas like abortion, affirmative action, and the like, where his vote has replaced hers, leading to more conservative results. The left wing of the court is especially interesting now. I mean, Alito and Roberts have now been there several years, but the two newest justices are Sotomayor and Kagan. And the question here, I mean, it's not going to change the balance on the court. I mean, the justices that they have replaced were justices who tended to the left side of the court. So it's not a matter of counting votes. It's really more a matter of intellectual heft. Will Sotomayor and Kagan provide intellectual leadership on the court? Stevens' departure, I think, was a blow to the more liberal wing, just as Brennan's departure 20 years ago was to that side of the court. But I have the distinct impression that Sotomayor and now more recently Kagan have hit the ground running. I mean, typically there's a kind of freshman effect where it takes typically 2 or 3 years for a new justice to really kind of get in the swing of things. And that is emphatically not true with Justice Kagan, who seems to come out swinging from the beginning. And it's quite possible that Sotomayor and Kagan will become the Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan of the Roberts Court. I'm especially impressed with Kagan. If you want examples of her, the power of this justice's mind, read her dissents in the Arizona taxpayer standing case and in the Arizona public finance cases. They're well written, they're tightly reasoned, they're really quite eloquent, and I think they're very promising. I've also noticed the effect these new two justices have on oral argument. It's my impression, for what it's worth, that the pace of argument has picked up even more thanks to Sotomayor and Kagan. They are respectively more active in oral argument than Souter and Stevens were. For example, Sotomayor in the California prison case this term seems to me to have been especially active. In general, the court is a very different place in oral argument from what it was like back in the 1980s. The right wing, I think, is becoming familiar, Thomas and Scalia in particular. Thomas, there's probably no precedent that Thomas sees that he's not willing to question. I think if it were five Thomases on the court, Gibbons versus Ogden might be roadkill. Consider that. There's nothing that's too sacred to be questioned. Alito's interesting. I'm finding he's becoming one of the court's more interesting characters. He, in these First Amendment cases, of course, Leslie Kendrick will be talking about those, where the court, where a heavy majority finds a First Amendment violation, Alito is more likely to be sensitive to community feelings about things like violent videos or animal cruelty or funeral protests. So even though he and Roberts are clearly very much in lockstep most of the time, there's that interesting exception. It's a term in general that we probably would not identify blockbusters. There's not a Citizens United or a Bush versus Gore this term, but it's a very meaningful term, especially in the First Amendment area, in preemption, and in class actions, the three areas that we'll be taking up here. First Amendment, for example, it's really quite striking that you have the sort of robust affirmation of First Amendment values in a number of areas. The class action questions, cases raise the question whether the Roberts Court ought to be seen as pro-business. Progressive or liberal critics of the court attack the Roberts Court as being just in league with business interest, and it's certainly true, we'll be talking about some of these cases here, certainly true that the Chamber of Commerce and those folks won some of the big ones, like Walmart and AT&T. The drug companies did well this term in preemption and free speech cases. But on the other hand, in cases involving retaliation against employees and the illegal immigrant case that David Martin will talk about, went against the Chamber of Commerce's arguments. So it's a court I think you can paint with broad brush and make some generalizations, but they necessarily have to be stated with some care and some qualification. So with that, that's a term well worth talking about, and I'm grateful to my colleagues here who are taking up specific cases, so let me therefore turn to David Martin.
Thanks very much, Dick. I'm very pleased to be a part of this roundup once again. My topic is one that maybe doesn't hold quite the intrinsic interest that some of the topics some of my colleagues will address might do, and that is preemption doctrine, the supremacy of federal law over state law. There were three main cases this term on federal preemption. Two of them looked like fairly straightforward applications of recent precedents applying very similar federal statutes, or the same federal statutes. I'm going to touch just quickly on those two, and then I'll go on to the one that did receive a lot more attention, the Arizona law called the Legal Arizona Workers Act. The first of these was called Williamson versus Mazda Motors. A passenger riding in the middle seat in the back without a shoulder belt, had a lap belt on but not a shoulder belt, was killed in an accident. It was a suit against the manufacturer based on the idea that this was a defective product the car was, because it didn't have the shoulder belt. The California court held that a state law standard of liability that would allegedly have required a shoulder belt in that setting was preempted by a federal safety standard that gave manufacturers an option. It didn't require them to have a shoulder belt there, gave them an option to use a lap only or a lap shoulder belt. And that seemed like a really solid ruling because just a few years before, in 2000, the Supreme Court had ruled in a case called Geyer versus Honda, American Honda Motors, that a state standard of liability that would have required airbags to be installed by the manufacturers was preempted by basically the same federal, the same section of the federal safety standards, which didn't say no airbags. It said the manufacturer has an option, airbags or other kinds of passive restraints. So in one case, it says option, airbags or other passive restraints. In another case, the federal standard says option for the manufacturer, lap belt or lap and shoulder belt. Seems solid. California Supreme Court said preemption. Wrong. The Supreme Court said, no, you have to look much more closely at this part of the federal safety standard and its history and all of the little nuances of what it was that the agency said about it. And if you do so, you will discover that this preserving of choice in this setting, as distinguished from the airbag setting, was not really a, quote, significant regulatory objective of the Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Therefore, no implied preemption. So, okay, all right. It seems like maybe the mood in the court these days is to find or to put very high standards before you find that there would be preemption of a state law rule, particularly in the tort field. So in that light, the next case looks like it's pretty solid. It's called Pleva Incorporated versus Mensing. It's a drug labeling case about a duty to warn case. The Fifth and the Eighth Circuits had found no preemption of state law in cases where the plaintiff was harmed from using a drug that allegedly had a label that was insufficient under the state law standard. The warning label was insufficient. So that seems solid because this time, just 2 years before, in a case called Wyeth versus Levine, the Supreme Court had held that the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, labeling requirements did not preempt an insufficient labeling action against another drug manufacturer. So, no preemption, precedent 2 years old, rely on that if you're a judge. Wrong again. The court says you've got to look a lot more closely at the actual FDA regulations, the details that are applicable to this particular this particular kind of drug. This was a generic drug, not a brand name drug. Brand name drugs had a few more options. Generic drug manufacturers couldn't quite maneuver as much. There's conflict preemption, and therefore there is preemption in this case. In both cases, distinguishing the earlier precedents that weren't really all that old. So the lessons from these two cases may be, one, relying on precedent gets you nowhere as a lower court judge in a preemption case. Two, you better read the minute details of the regulations in the legislation, consult the zeitgeist, look at the context, and then try to make your decision. Or three, just hope that five justices get up on the right side of the bed for you the morning of the argument. I'm not going to try to analyze them. Read the statutes carefully, the federal statutes, standards, regulations, if you're trying to figure out whether there's preemption. Let me turn on now to the one that received greater attention. It's called Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting. It's a federal preemption challenge to an Arizona law cracking down on immigration, on illegal immigration. But it was not a challenge to the Arizona law that you've all heard about and that we followed so closely, I think, over the last year and a half or so. This other, more controversial law was passed in April 2010. It's called SB 1070. The district court preliminarily enjoined that statute in July, the SB 1070, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed in April. Cert is pending in that case, and the state of Arizona has hired Paul Clement, former Solicitor General, to argue that case and to present that case to the Supreme Court and to argue it if in fact, cert is granted. So that particular one, SB 1070, made it a state crime, essentially, to be in the United States unlawfully. And it required police to check the immigration status of everybody who was arrested in Arizona before they were released, and also to check the status of many others that law enforcement would have encountered. Though that statute, the implementation of most of that statute has been enjoined on a preemption lawsuit filed by the Department of Justice, preliminarily enjoined. There still have been many copycat pieces of legislation that have been enacted over the last year, particularly Georgia and Alabama, to a somewhat lesser extent, South Carolina, Indiana, and Utah. So when Whiting comes along, it's not decided until after there's been all this attention to SB 1070, the 2010 law. But Whiting dealt with a 2007 law from Arizona called the Legal Arizona Workers Act. The ruling in Whiting was awaited by many to see what implications it might seem to hold for future rulings on the 2010 Arizona law. And when the court then upheld the 2007 statute against a preemption claim, much commentary rushed to judgment to say, well, the court's clearly going to approve SB 1070. I want to say, not so fast. There's far less in Whiting for these purposes than it may initially meet the eye. So let me explain a little bit further. The Arizona law in Whiting, Legal Arizona Workers Act, found its genesis in a very similar kind of ugly legislative environment in Arizona back in 2007, where the Arizona legislature was passing, well, a wide variety of crackdown type legislation addressed to illegal migration. But Jan Brewer was not the governor of Arizona at that time. Our alumna, Janet Napolitano, was the governor. And she has been a strong supporter of immigration enforcement, but also takes a somewhat, shall we say, more nuanced view of the way in which policy should develop in this field. So she vetoed many of those other hard crackdown provisions, some of which had provisions like the ones eventually enacted in 2010. But she signed this law, the Legal Arizona Workers Act, in part as a kind of outlet for the immigration anger that was very prevalent in that state. A flat veto across the board might simply have meant that there would have been a referendum that would have imposed the stronger provisions as a matter of citizen voting. As it turned out, it worked in that way, politically, for at least 3 years. There was no referendum. The Legal Arizona Workers Act did seem to afford an outlet for saying, well, we're doing something about this, and let this particular set of steps with regard to illegal immigration take effect. LAWA, Legal Arizona Workers Act, is a focused set of measures designed to make use of a savings clause in an express preemption provision in something called IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. And they use this, I'll explain that licensing exemption in a moment. Arizona's drafters wanted to magnify the consequences for employers who knowingly hire unauthorized workers, and they would use this savings clause to be able to do it. At least that was their theory. So IRCA enacted in 1986 a comprehensive set of federal provisions forbidding the hire of unauthorized workers and providing for a verification system. You've all gone through it, the I-9 review process. That statute did address preemption issues expressly. It provided, the act expressly preempts, quote, any state or local law imposing civil or criminal sanctions, and then here's the savings clause, paren, other than through licensing and similar laws, close paren, upon those who employ, recruit, or refer unauthorized aliens. So preempting any state or local law imposing civil or criminal sanctions other than through licensing and similar laws that deal with unlawful hiring. So under this law, if employers are found to have committed violations, knowing and intentional violations, unlawfully hiring unauthorized workers, then they would lose their business licenses, and the statute was drafted to cover a whole lot of different kinds of permits that businesses get, including corporate charters and counting those as licenses. The Chamber of Commerce, one of the plaintiffs here, called this the business death penalty for hiring unlawful workers. Significantly, LAWA also required employers in Arizona, virtually all of them, to use the E-Verify system. That's an electronic system, an internet-based system for checking the work authorization status of new hires. It's a relatively new system, E-Verify is. It's had some growing pains, but it has actually made a lot of progress in improving the system. I'd say quite significant progress over the last 5 years in improving the accuracy and the ease of use of the system by employers. Justice Breyer, who dissented here, wanted to find this law to be preempted, really distorts, either misunderstood or badly distorted or a little bit of both, the actual accuracy rate and effectiveness of E-Verify. Despite those improvements, there were still a number of objections that brought together a group of plaintiffs here. Some of them were business, Chamber of Commerce and other businesses. They saw this as an unwarranted and unnecessary burden requiring all employers to use E-Verify. And then also they aligned with the immigrant advocacy community and a number of civil rights groups, I think in part because there are signs that E-Verify might be really effective and denying work to people who are not authorized to work in this country. And I don't want to distort that. There are a number of those organizations, advocacy organizations, who are okay with getting to that kind of a system at some point, but only as part of a comprehensive immigration reform bill that would provide some sort of way for people who've been here for many years unlawfully to obtain some kind of legal work authorization, and therefore when that system goes into effect, they could sustain their jobs, but it could then primarily deter work applications by future migrants. So they came together, challenged the statute on preemption grounds. This is the kind of challenge you see, a real kind of strange bedfellows coalition here, the Chamber of Commerce along with the organizations, civil rights organizations. This was originally titled in the district court, Chicanos por la Causa versus Napolitano. Maybe they had a deal where the other party gets to be listed first as on the list of parties when it gets to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court is Chamber of Commerce versus Whiting. Two basic challenges here. One, an express preemption challenge. They invoked the general rule of IRCA, which is a general baseline rule. We are preempting other sorts of state regulation in this arena. But then it all came down to what is the meaning of the licensing exception, the savings clause. The court said, well, this fits. A plain language reading would say that Arizona is using the licensing exception. Plaintiffs argued that, well, these kinds of permissions from the state don't really count as licensing. They're reaching much too far. The Supreme Court said, look at the definition of licensing in the Administrative Procedure Act. This fits. This all fits very well. It is anomalous, it's true, because this means a higher sanction than what the state would incur if it just tried to impose fines, which are expressly preempted. But they said there's no real support in the text for finding other ways of reading it. They also considered an implied preemption challenge. The plaintiff said this should be tested against a standard from a case called Hines versus Davidowitz. Is this statute an obstacle to the achievement and execution of the full purposes and objectives of Congress? And they maintained that it was because the full federal statute had a balance between provisions against unlawful hiring and anti-discrimination provisions, an important part of the package deal enacted in 1986. The Supreme Court was unmoved by that, primarily because they said this package is entirely, this Arizona law is entirely harmonious with the federal statute. This won't cause people to swing way to the side of potentially discriminating because it's only a punishment for intentional and knowing hire. It directly tracks in definition and verification of status what the federal law provides. And then finally, there was a challenge because some parts of federal law say that the Secretary of Homeland Security must run E-Verify as a voluntary system with some very limited exceptions. The claim was that therefore preempts any state effort to make it mandatory. The Supreme Court said, again, we look at the plain text that says the secretary cannot make it mandatory. That wasn't intended to block states from requiring that. The dissents brought together Justice Breyer, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Ginsburg. Justice Kagan recused because she had been involved as Solicitor General in some of the early stages of preparing the government's case here. Their main challenge was to read the licensing exception so that it wouldn't save this law, but still wouldn't be just rendered a nullity. It obviously had to mean something. It had to provide a safe harbor for some kinds of efforts states could do under licensing laws. Two ideas were put forward. Justice Sotomayor said it only allows the states to suspend licenses when a federal administrative law judge has already formally found under IRCA, the federal statute, that there has been a knowing violation. And Justice Breyer was even more creative, and he said the savings clause only applies to licensed labor contractors, those who recruit or refer for a fee. They had been the subject of some discussion about licensing schemes at the time of enactment. The majority said that just, you know, it's creative, nice job, folks, but it just doesn't fit at all with the text of the provision itself. So the court upheld the Legal Arizona Workers Act 5-3. The press read it as a likely signal of how SB 1070 would be read, but I want to submit that's not at all clear. Whiting, at heart, is an express preemption case. It's a narrow question of statutory interpretation that's presented. How far do those seven words in parentheses in IRCA really reach? There's no comparable statutory provision, either express preemption or a savings clause, that applies in the SB 1070 setting. Furthermore, Whiting emphasizes at several points, the Supreme Court's ruling emphasizes, that LAWA is closely harmonious with federal plans and priorities. It emphasizes that the statute, quote, closely tracks the federal immigration provisions in all material respects. That's not true of SB 1070. And the SB 1070 case is shaping up almost entirely as an implied preemption case, particularly applying this notion about whether the Arizona law is an obstacle to full achievement of the purposes and objectives of the federal government. One other significant distinction is that the federal government jumped in very early to challenge SB 1070 and to say, to offer a lot of arguments why this interferes with federal policy, complicates our foreign policy, is a mismatch with other sorts of provisions, falls afoul of Hines versus Davidowitz. That's very different from the stance the federal government had taken with the LAWA case. They had stayed out of it, although they'd been invited in at various times. They finally came in, the federal government finally came in, when the Supreme Court asked the Solicitor General to provide the views of the federal government. The federal government at that time stepped in and said they thought that it was preempted, but obviously the court ruled against them. So in any event, the federal government is very much in the forefront of the challenge to the Arizona law and just recently filed suit against a similar and even harsher law in Alabama. With respect to just a final thought here, some of the questions in the SB 1070 case are really a closer call and present some more subtle issues than is commonly understood. I won't try to go into those, but I just want to say Whiting doesn't really at all dictate or even lean very hard one way or another towards a direction in which the court might resolve some of those issues. Now, let me just step back for a moment from a policy and political perspective. I think it's probably good that the Supreme Court upheld the Legal Arizona Workers Act, maybe for a lot of reasons like the ones that went through Governor Napolitano's mind when she signed it back in 2007. It may be a way to help channel more of the state crackdown energy into provisions like that that focus on E-Verify and away from the kinds of elaborate, detailed, unfriendly attrition through enforcement provisions of the type that appear in SB 1070. And channeling may be necessary because there is a lot of high energy in many states about immigration crackdowns that need some kind of an outlet. I do worry that immigration advocates sometimes rely way too heavily on a smug assurance that the courts are going to strike down these kinds of provisions applying the doctrines of preemption, instead of really working hard to help find alternative enforcement regimes that in the long run really could help us achieve a more effective and more humane and targeted enforcement regime overall. Preemption, even if the court here eventually does say that SB 1070 is preempted, preemption is a strange kind of constitutional ruling. It is a constitutional ruling. There's a violation. If there's this conflict, there's a violation of Article 6 of the Constitution, the Supremacy Clause. But it's a kind of constitutional ruling that can be overturned by Congress. Congress can pass a statute that would consent to state law provisions of this time. And without an outlet of some kind for this energy, I am worried that at some point down the road, with a few more years of deadlock at the federal level, on immigration, Congress may just throw up its hands and pass something that says, okay, states are turned loose. In any event, I see Whiting as a modestly significant ruling, but one that does not shed much light on this future battle that is likely to come up within the next couple of years in the Supreme Court. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Leslie Kendrick. I am also very glad to be here. Also, like Dick, a former member of the Student Legal Forum. Secretary of that organization once upon a time. So I'm going to talk to you today about two First Amendment cases. The first is Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association, and the second is Snyder versus Phelps. You may have heard of both of them. Brown involves the sale of violent video games to minors, and Snyder versus Phelps involves pickets at funerals. I'm going to argue that the two are related in what they say about free speech law. But let's start with Brown. Let's start with your constitutional right to play Call of Duty 4. So Brown involves a California law that imposes civil fine for selling violent video games to minors under 18 who didn't have their guardian's consent. Now, violent here is defined as a game where you have the option of killing, maiming, dismembering, or sexually assaulting an image of a human being. So I guess zombie games are safe, maybe? I'm not sure how zombies process under that. But and on top of that, the game has to appeal to deviant or morbid interests in minors, has to be patently offensive to community standards on what's appropriate for minors, and taken as a whole has to lack serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value for minors. So in other words, most video games, right? And the rationale is that these games lead to violent behavior in those who play them. Along comes the Entertainment Merchants Association. This is a video gaming trade association that has gone around challenging laws like this in all the states where they've been passed, and they have met with much success. In fact, they have never lost. They always win. And they won here in the district court, and they won here in the Ninth Circuit on First Amendment grounds, which leads to the question, if there's no disagreement about this, and there isn't, your right, your constitutional right to play Call of Duty 4 has uniformly been vindicated in the courts. Why did the Supreme Court take this case? And I have no idea. I raised the question just to say it's a mystery why the court took this case, but it did, and this is what it said. We have an opinion written by Justice Scalia, joined by Kennedy, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan, affirming the Ninth Circuit and striking down the law. They say, first of all, that video games are expression for First Amendment purposes. And they say, beyond that, and the expression we're talking about here doesn't fall into an unprotected category of speech. They say, in cases where we've recognized an unprotected category of speech as to minors, we've always been piggybacking off of some unprotected category of speech for adults. So an example would be obscenity. We have an unprotected category of obscenity with respect to adults. And because that exists, we can have a broader, more expansive category of speech that's obscene with respect to minors. So that's why in the bookstore, Playboy magazine is under wraps, right? Because of the concern. It's not obscene with respect to adults, but it might be obscene with respect to minors. That's assuming there is still Playboy magazine and assuming that there are still bookstores. I don't really know. But if you know what I'm talking about, that's an example. But the court says there is no similar unprotected category of violent speech with respect to adults. Right? There's no unprotected violent speech as to adults. And furthermore, there's no tradition of regulating violent speech as to minors, CEG, Grimm's Fairy Tales, and a number of other very violent traditional fare for children. Nor is the fact that video games are interactive any reason to treat them differently from these other forms of media. The court says all literature is interactive. That's not a reason to treat video games differently. So because the speech doesn't fall into an unprotected category, that means this law is a content-based regulation, meaning it targets speech because of what it's saying. It singles out violent speech as opposed to nonviolent speech. And as a content-based regulation, it gets strict scrutiny and it fails. The court says California can't even contend here that the empirical evidence on this clearly establishes a link between playing violent video games and having violent conduct. All California is asking us to do is defer to the legislature's judgment on that point, and that we won't do. Justice Alito writes a concurrence on narrower grounds and is joined by the Chief Justice. He says, I think this particular law is fatally vague. It doesn't give enough notice of what constitutes a violent video game for purposes of the statute, but some law on this hypothetically could pass muster. And furthermore, the majority shouldn't rule out of hand the possibility that video games are qualitatively different from other media in their capacity for harm. Justice Thomas dissents, saying, I interpret the First Amendment according to the public meaning of it at the time that it was adopted. Minors didn't have First Amendment rights because they were under complete control of their parents, so that's very easy. Justice Breyer, meanwhile, dissents, saying, yes, the majority's right that this is content-based law. Yes, it should get strict scrutiny, but it should pass strict scrutiny. The majority is wrong in the way that it assesses the governmental interest in protecting minors here. That interest is actually a lot stronger than the majority would have us think. So that's what the court says in Brown. Let's put Snyder on the table, and then we'll talk about what it all means. So Snyder is the case involving funeral picketing. We have a service member, Marine Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder, who's killed in action in Iraq, and his family has a funeral for him in Maryland. Who should decide to show up but the Westboro Baptist Church? This is a church made up mostly, I think pretty much all, of relatives of Fred Phelps, the leader of the church, and they believe that homosexuality is a sin and that our deaths in war are the result of God's rage at the presence of gays in the military. And they like expressing this message at the funerals of service members and high-profile people also, like Elizabeth Edwards. And the less said about them, the better, because obviously what they want out of all of this, is for people to be talking about them. Right? So that's all I'll say about them. But they show up to picket at this funeral. They're 1,000 feet from the funeral, and they have some signs with some objectionable messages. For example, God hates the USA, thank God for 9/11, thank God for IEDs, thank God for dead soldiers, you're going to hell, God hates gay people, I'm paraphrasing there. A few weeks later, they post an epic online that says that Matthew's parents raised him for the devil, that he was a Catholic idolater, adulterer, and fornicator, and that he worked for the sinful US military. The plaintiff here is Matthew's father, who actually doesn't see the picket at the funeral. He doesn't see it at all, but he sees about it on the evening news after the funeral, and he reads the epic online. And he sues, making a number of claims, including intentional infliction of emotional distress and intrusion upon seclusion. And on those claims, he wins at the trial court, is awarded $2.9 million in compensatory damages, $8 million in punitive damages, which the district court judge knocks down to 2.1 for a total judgment of $5 million. The Fourth Circuit overturns the verdict, saying that the speech was protected under the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court again agrees. The Supreme Court affirms the Fourth Circuit on this point. And the Chief Justice writes a majority opinion for all of the justices of the court except for Alito. First, we have to make clear, and the opinion makes clear, it's clear that Snyder's claim rests on the message of the protest. Right? There was no disruption was caused at the funeral by the protest. And in fact, I've said Mr. Snyder wasn't even aware that the protest was going on at the time of the funeral. It's quite clear, and Snyder's quite clear, that his claim is that the emotional distress involved here was inflicted by the message of the protest. So the court says that message, that speech, is protected speech under the First Amendment, and says that the determinative factor really is that the speech was speech about matters of public concern, concerns like military policy, nation stance toward homosexuality, and so forth. Yes, there were a few signs that could be taken to say something about Matthew personally. The court points out the signs that say you're going to hell or God hates you, but says the overall thrust and dominant theme of the protest was matters of public concern. So much for the picket, but you might say, well, what about the epic? The epic seemed to talk about Matthew a whole lot more. The court says it will refuse to consider the epic because it says Snyder didn't properly raise it. It wasn't addressed in the petition for cert, and Snyder only spent a paragraph of his merits brief talking about the petition. So as far as the court's concerned, it's not at issue in this case. We have Breyer, who joins the majority opinion but writes a concurrence, which I'll come back to in a minute. He writes separately. And then Alito dissents and says, funerals are very special settings. The Phelpses have a whole nation to protest in and to get their message out in, and yet they choose this very private occasion to do it. And furthermore, the majority is downplaying the extent to which the picket could be taken to relate to Matthew Snyder. So on top of the signs about going to hell, there were signs that reasonably could be read to imply that Matthew was gay. And then you have the whole epic, which is clearly talking about Matthew as a person. Basically, Alito thinks there's no reason for the Westboro Baptist Church to drag a private person into their dissemination of their message on public issues. Breyer concurs basically to identify that same issue and says, look, I don't take the majority's opinion to say anything about a case in which a speaker, in talking about a matter of public concern, brings in private details of a private person's life. He says the majority says this is not that case, so I don't take this case, this opinion, to be saying anything about a case like that. So that's Snyder versus Phelps. What do these two cases have in common? First, both of them involve content-based regulation. Content-based regulation targets speech because of its message, because of its says, typically because of its subject matter or its viewpoint. So here, violent speech, offensive speech, political speech. That's the type of thing that content-based regulations are targeting. They're contrasted with content-neutral regulations, which regulate speech based on something other than its message. So a noise ordinance that targets speech because of its volume, that's content-neutral. That's why it's very significant in Snyder versus Phelps that the claim was not that the noise of the protest in some way disrupted the funeral. That would be a very different case. So they both involve content-based regulation. And the court generally disfavors content-based regulation. It has to pass strict scrutiny. But the court has said that there are certain compelling interests that may be able to justify content-based regulation. It's identified some ab initio that may be compelling enough to warrant it. And one is the protection of minors, and the other is the protection of the privacy of private individuals. So both of these cases implicate an interest where the court has said, hypothetically, this interest may justify content-based regulation. And as we've seen in both cases, the court resolves against that interest in favor of its general policy of suspicion of content-based regulation. I think that in both cases, the court fudges a bit to downplay the extent to which those potentially compelling interests are squarely implicated by the case. In Brown, I think it does this on the law. First of all, it suggests that we only have special speech rules as to minors. It at least, I think, fairly implies this. We only have special speech rules as to minors where we already have a pre-existing unprotected category of speech as to adults, like in the obscenity context, where plainly in some other cases, the court has had special concerns about minors' access to speech that doesn't trouble them with respect to adults. The primary example here would be vulgarity, where in cases like Pacifica about broadcast television and radio, or Bethel about vulgarity in schools, the court has plainly had a concern about protecting minors from vulgar speech that it does not have with respect to adults. Also, the school cases generally suggest that we have concerns about speech in minor contexts that we don't have when we're talking about adult contexts. Also, the court dismisses out of hand the idea that we would think a particular medium has special features that we would be concerned about. We can't think violent video games are different from other types of violence. All literature is interactive, right? But in other cases, the court has discriminated between media based on special features. It treats cable differently from broadcast. It treats broadcast differently from print media on the rationale that broadcast is more invasive of our homes than print media is. Obscenity cases, for example, strongly imply that written material can hardly, if ever, be considered obscene. It's a category that's almost, if not entirely, pertaining to visual media. So that seems like a little bit of a misrepresentation of some concerns that have been clearly active in other cases. Meanwhile, Snyder on the facts, the idea that this is purely public speech, it's not about Matthew. First of all, ignoring the epic makes this much easier contention, and had the epic been something that the court was willing to address, I think it might have had to think differently about this. But many people would probably agree with the court that the funeral protest does involve matters of public concern. I think fewer people would agree that it didn't also implicate Matthew Snyder as a person. Not only did some signs suggest that he was going to hell, some other signs suggested that he was gay, and in fact, the entire protest, I think, suggests that these policies that the Phelpses are against in the United States government, that Matthews personally implicated in them. In fact, I think the gravamen of the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim is exactly that. It's not that distressing if someone has, for example, a circus next to my funeral. That might be annoying, but it's not intentionally hurtful in the way that this protest is. The very reason this was hurtful is that it suggests that Matthew, as a person, was complicit in or implicated in these larger matters of public concern. So I think there, too, we have a little bit of fudging to suggest that this interest isn't quite as implicated as it might otherwise be. Now, why is the court doing this? Why would it be downplaying these interests? So one possibility is it would do this to keep a clear rule. It has this general rule that it's against content-based discrimination. It has these hypothetical exceptions, but if it starts thinking that these exceptions might actually be implicated in these cases and talking about them in those terms, it sets potential precedent for lower courts, which pay a lot of attention to the very few things that the court says in these areas, that they will start finding those interests and using them to vindicate speech restrictions in contexts where they shouldn't. But the flip side is the same thing works in the other direction. If in cases like this the court downplays the extent to which these interests are really live, it might encourage lower courts to do the same thing, causing them not to acknowledge these interests in cases where they're actually squarely implicated. So I just can close by suggesting that these are very clear rules, but clear rules can sometimes have costs. Thanks.
Pleasure to be here. It's a special pleasure for me to look out in the audience and see some of my students from Civil Procedure who were with me at 8:30 this morning. Like me, I guess you just can't get enough of this subject. So I'm here to talk about two cases, Walmart Stores against Dukes and AT&T Mobility against Concepcion. Let me summarize my talk in six words. The decline of the deterrent class action. That's what we saw this term in the Supreme Court. Some people take a more radical view. They think there is no future for class actions. I think that's belied by other recent decisions of the Supreme Court. But class actions to promote deterrence, to prevent future wrongdoing, or to obtain a degree of approximate relief for a large class, I think are now a thing of the past. Let me explain. My students, current and former, also know that I never miss an opportunity to cite a federal rule of civil procedure, so let me succumb to that temptation now. These are cases that implicate Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23 on class actions. It's a detailed rule. Walmart in particular goes into the subdivisions of the rule in great detail. But I think in order to understand these cases, it's really necessary to take a very broad view of class actions. They are a mechanism for aggregating claims, typically small claims that cannot efficiently be pursued in individual actions. The aggregation is for two different purposes. One, to provide compensation to class members, to give them an efficient alternative to individualized litigation. The second is to provide incentives for plaintiffs, and in particular for plaintiffs' counsel, to bring class actions in order to deter wrongdoing. The device is really an attempt to bring together a lot of small claims in order to serve the broad purposes of obtaining compliance with the law and compensating the victims of wrongdoing. Let me say why these two cases really make it very difficult to bring a class action except one that is narrowly targeted on giving individualized determinations of damages or other forms of compensatory relief. A Walmart Stores Against Duke was a very large class action. The class was eventually certified with 1.5 million members. Women, current and former employees of Walmart, who alleged that they were denied promotions and denied increases in pay because of their sex. The class action stretched all the way across the country. It was certified as an injunctive class action in the jargon of Rule 23 under Subdivision B2. The Supreme Court held that certifying a case that big for an injunction was not proper under the rules because the plaintiffs also sought compensatory relief. Now, just a moment's calculation will persuade you that the compensatory relief they sought extended into the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. We're talking about thousands of dollars per employee that they were denied over their careers at Walmart. The Supreme Court said that this kind of case cannot be certified simply as an injunction to prevent future wrongdoing. Now, why is that so significant? It's so significant because nobody in the popular press seems to understand that the Supreme Court was absolutely unanimous on this view. It was 9-0. There were 5 conservative justices, but there were 4 liberal justices who signed on to that part of the opinion. What that means, and Justice Scalia goes into this in some detail in his opinion for the unanimous court, is that you can have a class action for damages, but you have to meet a much stricter part of the rule, subdivision B3, and you have to have individualized hearings on exactly what compensation the members of the class receive. This is a real blow to class actions that are aimed just at preventing wrongdoing. In fact, it makes it pretty difficult to imagine class actions like Walmart ever going forward at all. There's some talk in the plaintiff's bar that they might be able to break up this class action into smaller statewide, regional classes with fewer than 1.5 million members. But I think that's impossible, given the unanimous holding of the Supreme Court. You would have to try to certify it under a stricter provision of the rule, and the court says that you cannot make any kind of approximation to what individual class members would receive. The part of the opinion that has received the most press has to do with another issue in which the court did divide 5-4, and that concerns whether any class action could be certified under any subdivision of the rule. The 5 nominally conservative judges held that there were not common questions of law and fact among the class. Now, here too, the decision, although it was quite controversial, is a little difficult to argue with. The plaintiff's claim was that the common questions among members of the class were subjective management decisions by Walmart supervisors and managers all around the country. So the common questions involved individualized decision-making by thousands of different supervisors and managers. It's hard to see a common question in all of those separate decisions. The plaintiff's evidence that there was a common question really depended upon, you know, very dubious social science evidence. I won't go into the details of such evidence, but I will say that our colleagues, my fellow faculty members here at the University of Virginia, Larry Walker, John Monahan, and Greg Mitchell, were cited by the Supreme Court for exactly how dubious the evidence was. Most people who look at the case see it as a matter of sex discrimination and that it needs to be remedied. They should look a little more closely at the evidence that the plaintiffs put forward. It is, on examination, extraordinarily weak. Now, you might agree You might disagree with this controversial part of the holding, but remember, the Supreme Court was unanimous in saying that you can't get compensatory relief on this scale in a case which is certified mainly for an injunction. Now, let me say a word about AT&T Mobility. Now, this is a complicated preemption case, and Dave Martin has discussed the nuances of preemption, how it depends upon particular state law and the particular federal law that are involved. If anything, AT&T Mobility is more hostile, more devastating for class actions than Walmart. The case concerned a consumer contract. It was one for a cell phone. It contained an arbitration clause that said any dispute between the parties has to go to arbitration. It cannot go to litigation. It cannot go to a class action. It cannot go to class-wide arbitration. It has to be resolved in an individual arbitration proceeding. This contract was entered in California. California had a rule that such arbitration provisions were invalid. They were unconscionable, they were unfair to the consumer, and therefore they could not be enforced. So at one level, we have the contract, individualized arbitration. At the next level, state law. Such arbitration clauses are invalid. What the court decided was that federal law, in the form of the Federal Arbitration Act, invalidated state law and in turn required the contractual arbitration clause to be enforced. Now, AT&T Mobility is, as I said, a consumer contract case, but the reasoning of the decision applies equally well to employment contracts. So that many employers around the country, with quite a bit of justification in other precedents of the Supreme Court, can put arbitration clauses into the contracts of employment and force their employees into individualized arbitration cases. That means the case never gets to court. That means there's never an attempt to certify it. You don't even get to the hurdles of certification that are imposed by Walmart. This is, I think, a truly startling development. The Supreme Court in AT&T Mobility, consistently with what Dave Martin said, was somewhat closely divided on this question of preemption. After all, it involves federal-state relations. And one way to look at the case is the court divided 4-1-4 because Justice Thomas was the deciding vote. He's no friend of extended interpretation of the powers of the federal government, and he offered a highly qualified concurring opinion that may yet cut back on the scope of this case. But assuming neither decision suffers from retrenchment, I think what we have is a very pronounced policy now, both in class action proceedings under Rule 23 and in arbitration cases. If you have a class action where there are common questions that predominate among the class, and you can efficiently have individualized determinations of exactly what every class member gets, that fulfill the purpose of compensation, will allow that class action to go forward. This is quite a change from existing law. It makes it a lot harder to bring class actions, and it, in particular, makes it nearly impossible to bring a class action aimed simply at preventing wrongdoing or deterring it in the future. If you look at AT&T Mobility, what does it say? If you have a contract that provides for individualized arbitration and compensation, you have to use that. You can't use a class action. So what we have now is a whole body of law, newly reinforced by the Supreme Court, that makes it very difficult for class action lawyers, class action plaintiffs, actually to get their cases heard in federal court. And I think we will see the implications of these decisions explored in precedent, which is now, even now, beginning to be developed in the lower courts. And the era of the class action has entered a new and very restrictive phase. Thank you very much.
Thanks for those who are still here. I'm the last speaker. We're almost done, trust me. My job is a little different. I'm going to be talking about both the Supreme Court, but also the UVA Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, which I was involved in last year. For those of you who don't know, the clinic is a year-long class in which between 13 and 16 3Ls work on actual Supreme Court cases along with a series of instructors. It's everything from finding the cases to getting the Supreme Court to take the cases to working on them once they've been taken. The clinic is co-taught both by full-time faculty, including Professor Dan Ortiz, who's been with the clinic since the beginning, and then several lawyers who practice in a combination of Charlottesville, D.C., and New York. We work in teams. It's much like a law firm, essentially. The instructors essentially acting as partners in a law firm might while working on cases, and the students in the clinic doing many of the jobs that would be done by associates and sometimes by paralegals in cases that would be handled in the private law setting. This last year was the clinic's fifth year of operation, and by any conceivable standard, it was by far the most successful of the 5 years. We were counsel of record. We represented one of the parties at oral argument in 4 of the 75 cases before the Supreme Court last term, which last year was more than any other Supreme Court litigation clinic in the country. I think may have also been more than any single law firm before the Supreme Court last year. That was an unusual set of circumstances. We had a number of other sort of unique characteristics. We didn't just have 4 cases. We had 4 different attorneys argue before the Supreme Court. Professor Ryan argued a case last October, which was his first oral argument before the court. Mark Stancil, who is going to be the speaker at the next one of these events, argued another case. He was a year ahead of me in law school, so it's always fun to work with Mark. John Elwood, who is a former assistant to the SG, who I worked with at the Department of Justice, argued a third. And then the fourth was argued by Professor Ortiz, the founding director of the clinic. A couple other sort of fun little facts. We argued on both the first week and the last day of the term. Professor Ryan's case was one of the very first cases heard by the court all of last year. The case argued by John Elwood was the last oral argument of the 2010-2011 term. And along the way, Professor Ortiz and Mark Stancil argued back-to-back cases on the same day, which is also the first time that's ever happened in the history of the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic. So quite a year in a number of respects. What I want to use my remaining time now is to touch, obviously, very briefly on each of the 4 cases, both in their own terms, but also what they sort of say about Supreme Court litigation clinics. And in some ways, it worked out really well for me, because the first one we argued, the one Professor Ryan argued in October, is in many ways the prototypical Supreme Court litigation clinic type case. I say that it's a criminal case. It's my sense that most litigation clinic cases are either criminal or immigration for one very simple reason. There are a ton of cases, and the people who are opposing the government usually don't have a lot of money. So the offer for free representation before the Supreme Court of the United States is often very attractive to such people. So that is true in this case called Abbott versus United States. It's also typical in 2 other respects. First, the first is that involves a statute that involves that criminalizes the possession of firearms. An enormous amount of federal criminal prosecution involves firearm prosecution, and in particular, the statute that was at issue in this case, 18 U.S.C. 924C, which is essentially, if you're going to commit a felony, leave your gun at home. This is how the members of Congress who actually enacted this legislation characterized 924C. 924C imposes some rather draconian sentencing consequences on anybody who uses, carries, or possesses a firearm in connection with either a drug trafficking crime or a crime of violence. And the way that it does this is by imposing an additional sentence on you. Basically, in a nutshell, Congress has said, at minimum, the second you bring a gun to one of these crimes, you are looking at another 5 years in jail on top of any other sentence you're already getting. So the particular issue in Abbott involved what's called the accept clause. 924C says you get at least 5 years except as a higher sentence is, quote, otherwise provided either by 924C itself. So you think it's a bad news to bring a gun. It's even worse news to brandish or discharge the gun because the statute itself says if you brandish the gun, it's 7 years. If you discharge the gun, it's 10. And here's the key language here. It says is otherwise provided by, quote, any other provision of law. And the dispute in Abbott turned on what does that mean? The dispute between the petitioner, us, and the federal government was otherwise provided. What does it mean for a higher sentence to be otherwise provided by law? So we, not surprisingly representing the defendant, said that should be very broad. That should mean we basically argued for a transactional test. Is this defendant going to get a sentence of more than 5 years for the conduct that gave rise to the criminal transaction? Now, we argued that in this case, not surprisingly, that benefited our client, who was already subject to a 15-year mandatory minimum for another aspect of the crime. And we said, well, federal law has otherwise provided for a 15-year sentence, so there's no reason to tack an additional 5 years on top of it. The government's view, which ultimately the Supreme Court accepted by a vote of 8-0, was that, in fact, otherwise provided means otherwise provided for the very conduct prohibited by 924C itself. In other words, the conduct of carrying a firearm during and in relation to the drug trafficking crime or crime of violence. Unfortunately for our client, his other 15 years was provided for the gun. Unfortunately, in his case, it was provided for the fact that he had previously been convicted of several other crimes. The other message of federal gun statutes is once you've been convicted of one felony, you should really stop carrying guns. You should really, really stop carrying guns or very bad things are going to happen to you. So Mr. Abbott was unsuccessful. So the other three cases are a little different. They're all in one way atypical. None of them involve criminal defendants. They're also atypical in the sense that although none of them involve criminal defendants, they all involve conduct that in some ways is more seedy than the conduct involved in our criminal case. And so let me turn to those right now. I'm going to group two of these cases together. Two of these cases are both First Amendment-related cases, actually, in which we are representing government entities in both of them. So the next one is called Nevada Commission on Ethics against Kerrigan, which is the case that John Elwood argued on the last day of the term. And what this eventually involves is recusal rules for government officials. Like a lot of states, Nevada has rules that says government officials shall not participate in certain kinds of decisions in which they have certain kinds of disqualifying conflicts of interest. This involved a Nevada recusal rule as applied to a local legislator who voted on a casino project, which just so happened to be sponsored by his campaign manager and close friend. He was sanctioned. It was pretty much a slap on the wrist, a pro forma sanction by the Nevada Commission on Ethics. But he nonetheless decided to challenge that before the Supreme Court of Nevada, saying it violated his First Amendment rights. The Supreme Court of Nevada agreed, and we represented actually the Nevada Commission on Ethics before the Supreme Court. So what's interesting about Kerrigan is that it actually presents a classic case about Supreme Court tactics. So normally speaking, as a Supreme Court advocate, the better advice is to urge the court to rule in your favor on the narrowest ground possible, right? Don't ask the court to go make some gigantic rule of law. Pick the narrowest rule of law that's going to possibly help you win your case. So in Kerrigan, that would mean probably either accepting or assuming for the sake of argument that the First Amendment imposes some sort of restriction on these kinds of rules, and then arguing that whatever restrictions those are, it's okay here. The problem, on the other hand, is that a number of justices, Justice Scalia is the most prominent of these, are very hostile to certain kinds of balancing tests when it comes to First Amendment rights. And the minute you accept that the First Amendment imposes some restrictions, you're almost inevitably going to start engaging in some sort of balancing test about whether this one goes too far or not far enough. In addition, there is the fact that the Supreme Court had never actually said that recusal rules like this implicate the First Amendment at all. And in fact, there was a lot of historical evidence, including a Senate Parliamentary Procedure Manual drafted by Thomas Jefferson in the early days of Congress that seemed to imply that they didn't. So what we, of course, ended up doing was the classic example of advocate courage. We tried to have it both ways. So we both argued that the First Amendment imposed no restrictions at all. And then we had a fallback position that said, even if it does, we still win. In fact, in this case, the court, in an opinion by Justice Scalia, accepted the broader argument and said, we have never held that recusal rules like this. The key component to Kerrigan's argument was that he had a personal First Amendment interest in the act of voting in his legislative capacity. And the Supreme Court said, no, you don't. The person who holds an office does not acquire a First Amendment right in voting in connection with the office. And we ended up actually winning the case unanimously, which is also true of the next case, actually, I'll talk about, which is the case that Dan Ortiz argued, which is Borough of Duryea versus Guarnieri. So this is a case, you've probably heard of them. This is the latest in the line of cases involving government employee speech. And the basic dilemma here is pretty easy to state, right? On one hand, the government has to be able to control the people it employs, like any other employer, because employees who say things can really harm their employers. On the other hand, the government is the government and is subject to the First Amendment. And so most of the battle in this context has been under the Free Speech Clause, and to simplify an enormous amount of doctrine, the Supreme Court has essentially tried to have it both ways in some ways and said, well, in order for a government employee to be protected by the Free Speech Clause for things they say in connection with their government employment, they have to have been speaking on a matter of public concern, something that interests the public, as opposed to the sort of internal operations of their employer. And there's been this public concern requirement that the Supreme Court has developed and refined over the years. So, of course, what does any rational plaintiff do? They try to get around that. And the way this one tried to get around it was by saying, oh, no. I'm not bringing this under the Free Speech Clause. I'm bringing this under a different provision of the First Amendment, the Petition Clause, the provision that gives me the right to petition the government for a redress of grievance, and the Petition Clause has no public concern requirement or public interest requirement whatsoever. So we ended up, of course, arguing that that was wrong, that you should, in fact, apply the public concern requirement. The Supreme Court agrees with us in a majority opinion. There is a concurring opinion that I think is a little bit interesting by Justice Scalia, where he raises the issue about that's all wrong. You shouldn't look at public concern because that doesn't really fit the petition clause. Instead, you should look at whether the petition is addressed to the government in its capacity as sovereign, which would implicate the petition clause, or it's essentially a complaint to your employer, in which case it doesn't really implicate the petition clause. This had actually come up at oral argument. Justice Scalia and Justice Kagan both got really obsessed with this idea at oral argument, which had put Dan Ortiz in a bit of a tough spot, because this is not the argument we'd made. So on one hand, you don't want to throw away a lifeline. You need 5 votes to win a case, right? And so on one hand, you don't want to smack away a friendly question by somebody who's trying to vote for you. On the other hand, you don't want to abandon a position that you think other justices might be attracted to because you could end up losing their votes. Lots of times people lose cases at oral argument more often than they win them. But Dan did a great job of that, of both saying, on one hand, of course, if you want to say that, you could say that. But if you want to do what we asked you to do, you could do that too, which is another sort of useful thing about Supreme Court advocacy, is trying to thread the needle, because one justice is trying to help you, but you could be simultaneously hurting yourself with other justices. So the last case I'll talk about is the one that I know best, both because I worked on it and because it involves an area I teach. It is also, I say for last, because it's the seediest of all of them, with the wonderful name Fox versus Vice. And the first bad news you need to know is that we represented the guy named Vice, for whom the name was somewhat apt. So this case arises out of the election for chief of police in the city of Vinton in Louisiana. And our guy was the incumbent sheriff, and Ricky Fox was the challenger. Our client was accused, and I don't know if I have to say accused after he was later convicted, for using a variety of dirty tricks to try to convince Mr. Fox to drop out of the race, including sending an anonymous letter, setting up a public confrontation between Vice and another guy at a basketball game, and leaking a bunch of information to the press. Fox stayed in, and he won the election, and our client, as I said, was later convicted of criminal extortion. So after he wins this election, Fox decides to get greedy, and he sues our client, Fox. And his complaint raised a bunch of things. There were state law claims, defamation, intentional infliction of emotional distress. But he also included some federal civil rights claims, some federal constitutional claims. Our client then used the existence of those federal claims to remove the case from state court to federal court, which he then moved to dismiss on the grounds that for various technical reasons, the federal claims were, by the time we got to the Supreme Court, everybody conceded were meritless. The state court, having dismissed the federal claims, then remanded the state claims back to state court. So with all that lead up, you're probably going to be thrilled to learn that the case that eventually got to the Supreme Court involved attorney's fees. In a nutshell, there is a federal statute that says that under certain circumstances, the prevailing party can get fees against the losing party. The standards are much stricter generally for prevailing defendants than for prevailing plaintiffs. And this case, again, essentially involved the circumstances in which a prevailing defendant will be able to get attorney's fees in the very common category of cases where some of the claims were frivolous and some of the claims were not frivolous. Now, of course, the plaintiff wanted to argue for the most extreme rule that benefited him. His argument was, because I had a single non-frivolous claim, you cannot get any attorney's fees against me for anything. We didn't quite go that far, but our argument was, all the time that we spent that can be fairly attributed to your frivolous claims we should get fees for, even if it's work we should have done anyway on the non-frivolous claims. The Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Kagan, sort of split the baby, essentially saying the defendant can get fees, but only for work that you would not have done but for the presence of the frivolous claims. Only the work that is exclusively attributable to the frivolous claims can support an award of attorney's fees. So that's a very quick run through of four cases. It was obviously a wildly successful term for the clinic, both on the merits and the numbers. And we hope you all apply at some point in the future. Thanks.